I hope I'll be able to get there. In this talk, I want to present an argument against the use of impact the evaluation research. This argument is based on history of science. And I should say that my own subject is history and philosophy of science. Moreover, this argument which I'm presenting can be used not just against impact measures, but against any kind of research assistance system, such as the RDA or the RDA. Now, what do I mean by a research assessment system? Well, here's a definition. A research assessment system is a system in which groups of researchers are assessed at intervals. If the assessment is good, the group retains its funding or gets more. While if the assessment is bad, the group's funds are reduced or perhaps removed or failed. Now, a research assessment system might seem at first sight to be an obvious and common sense procedure. We want to produce good research, so let us first find out who the good researchers are by an assessment, and then give funding to good researchers while removing it from bad researchers. In this way, we will obviously improve the quality of the research produced. So what could be wrong with this system? The defect in the system is, I claim, simple. The study of history of science shows that it is not quite possible for researchers to give accurate assessments. After 20 or 30 years, the assessments of a piece of research have normally reached a consensus, which does not change much thereafter. However, this consensus after 20 or 30 years may be wildly different from the judgments which were made at the time the research was first produced. Research which was then thought to be really important may, after 20 or 30 years, is seen as the exploration of a blind alley. While research which is thought then to be of no value may, after 20 or 30 years, be seen to be a crucial breakthrough. The phenomenon to which I wish to draw attention could be described as delayed recognition. Let us suppose that a scientist, Mr. S. say, publishes a paper in which he proposes a new theory based on his research, which after 30 years is recognized as a major advance in the field. It may well be that his fellow scientists working in that field may not immediately recognize that Mr. S's theory is a good one. They may initially think that Mr. S's theory is completely wrong and largely ignore his work. Mr. S may then have to continue developing his theory through his research and perhaps that of his supporters for many years before its value is recognized by the scientific community. So this is what I mean by the concept of delayed recognition. Just to summarize, a scientist, Mr. S. say, published a paper with a new theory. Initially, his fellow scientists are not impressed by this theory and ignore it. Mr. S. and a few supporters continue research to develop the theory. And after say, 30 years, Mr. S.'s theory comes to be generated and accepted. Now, the interesting point, which you learn from history of science, is that the delayed recognition is a very common phenomenon. It's not a rare phenomenon. And interestingly, it most often occurs for advances, which with hindsight are seen to be among the most important breakthroughs. It is moreover fairly easy to explain why it happens. According to Kuhn, and I think he's correct here, scientists always work within a framework of assumption or paradigm, which they accept that the idea is correct. Now, a major advance in research is likely to go against some of the assumptions in the dominant paradigm, as for the all, and some are likely to be challenged. So working scientists are likely to reject, at least initially, a theory which contradicts any of the basic assumptions of their paradigm. Hence, we would expect that the initially a negative reaction to what later turns out to be a major advance. So here's my explanation of delayed recognition. The new theory contradicts the dominant paradigm, which is accepted by all scientists working in the field. Most of the most important research breakthroughs contradict the then dominant paradigm on at least some points, and so are liable to the phenomenon of delayed recognition. In the light of this, let us turn to impact measures. The idea of an impact measure is to measure the quality of research data by impact on other researchers in the field, on government policy, or on business. I will begin by focusing on the impact on research, but we'll say something about impact on business later. I won't actually discuss impact on government. A simple way of measuring research impact would be to count the number of references to the paper made by other researchers. Now, if this is used to evaluate papers published 30 or 40 years ago, then I would say that it's a good measure of the quality of research in those papers. However, it is not a good measure of the quality of research in papers published in the previous 4 or 5 years, precisely because of the phenomenon of delayed recognition, which I've just described. Our scientist, Mr. S, who makes a major research advance, but one which is not recognized for 20 or 30 years, will initially get a very low value on an impact measure, although his research will be seen in hindsight as being of excellent quality. Thus, impact measures are not satisfactory measures of the quality of research produced in the previous few years. The phenomenon of delayed recognition is extremely common in the history of science. And if you're interested in this, you can find many examples in a book which I published recently. This is called How Research Should Be Organized. I published it in 2008 to coincide with the RE. So, more examples are found at the RE. Unfortunately, I didn't have much of that. It was out of the RAF as well. So it didn't have an impact on government. But if you're interested, it does give quite a large number of examples of this delayed impact phenomenon. But for a short talk, obviously, it might be a different one. And so I'll just focus on one, but this is a recent example, and actually it may be one that you would refer to. In the year 2008, Harold Thurhausen, a German scientist, there he is, was awarded the Nobel Prize for the discovery that a form of cervical cancer is caused by a preceding infection by the papillomavirus. He is in his laboratory when he made this discovery. In the research which led to the discovery, the majority of researchers favored the view that the causal agent for cervical cancer was a herpes virus and not a papillomavirus. This was the dominant paradigm at the time, and Thurhausen and his group were the only ones who favored the papillomavirus. They were a small group in Germany, they favored the papillomavirus. Everyone else, there are lots of research groups all over the world, they all were looking for herpes virus. That was the situation. Now, one of the reasons why the research community favored the idea that a herpes virus was the cause of cervical cancer was that it had been shown that the herpes virus, the Epstein-Barr virus, was the cause of another cancer, Burkitt's lymphoma. Now, I'll give you an illustration of the dominance of the herpes virus approach 30 years before. This is shown by the fact that in December 1972, there was an international conference of researchers in the area at Key Biscayne in Florida, which had the title Herpes Virus and Cervical Cancer. The title wasn't Virus and Cervical Cancer, it was Herpes Virus and Cervical Cancer. Thurhausen, much younger obviously in those days, attended this conference and made some criticisms of the herpes virus. He said that he believed that the results indicate at least a basic difference in the reaction of herpes simplex virus type 2 with cancer cells as compared to another herpes virus, the Epstein-Barr virus. In Burkitt's lymphomas and nasopharyngeal carcinomas, also called herpes virus, the tumor cells seem to be loaded with viral genomes, and obviously the complete viral genomes are tested. Cells. Thus, a basic difference to the brain seems to exist between these two systems. It is reported that the audience listened to Thurhausen in stony silence. The summary of the conference, written by George Klein, AIJ, and it does not mention Thurhausen. It is not mentioned. So clearly at this time, impact measures for Thurhausen's research would have been very low, if not almost zero. Although, of course, we now know that he probably did. By the way, I should just mention here that the credit here, because I think PhD student was working for him for a very long time, and he is investigating this case. Okay, I now turn to the impact of using languages. First of all, let us consider the specific example of Zuohausen's discovery that infection by papillomavirus causes cervical cancer. The impact measures have been used for research assessment in 1973, as fortunately they were not, that Zuohausen and his group could have got a very low rate. The research funding would have been cut off, and the discovery of the cause of cervical cancer would have been long delayed. Millions of dollars would still have been spent on searching for a herpesvirus causing cervical cancer, but no result would have been produced. Because actually, it's not caused by herpesvirus. We know that millions of dollars would have been spent because there were all these other research groups who were very well funded looking for a herpesvirus. And most of them, they weren't finding it, but they thought it was just kind of cause. Moreover, it would have been very difficult for Zuohausen or anyone else to challenge the dominant paradigm, which was that a herpesvirus caused cervical cancer. Because anyone who initially advocated such a view would have received a low rating on impact measures, and consequently had been denied funding. As a result, the development of a vaccine which protects against this unpleasant, not fatal disease, would have been delayed for several decades, while huge sums of money, notice, would have continued to be spent on research. It is worth noting that sales of the vaccine have generated large profits for pharmaceutical companies, so these profits would not have occurred either. So here is my summary of the impact in this specific example. First of all, funding for Zuohausen's group would have been cut off in the 1970s, and then impact was close to zero. Consequently, discovery of the viral cause of cervical cancer would have been delayed, but still millions of dollars would have been spent on search for herpesvirus causing cervical cancer. Obviously, we know now that they were doing it again. And pharmaceutical companies' profits from selling the vaccine would have been cut. So I'm just thinking a little bit about business. Now, let's now turn to the general effect of the use of impact measures in the research assessment systems after the RDF. I remarked earlier that the phenomenon of delayed recognition occurs most frequently in the case of big innovations, significant advances, and major breakthroughs. This is explained by the fact that advances of this kind usually contradict some features of the dominant paradigm, accepted by most scientists working in the field. Hence, we can conclude that the general impact of impact measures will be, there we are, the stifling of big innovations, significant advances, and major difficulties in research. It is also worth noting that it is precisely the big innovations which generate the largest problems for the private sector. In my book, actually, I consider quite a number of these major breakthroughs, which suffered from delayed recognition, and I point out that in each case, once they were known, they did generate a lot of problems. So, a subsidiary consequence then is to reduce profits in the private sector, and as the government is dedicated by all to generating more profits in the private sector, its advocacy of impact measures is a clear instance of treating itself.
Ideas in In thinking about the collaboration of challenge, we get, of course, close to the idea of, are we welcoming impact precisely because it tells us what we already think? How close is the relationship between knowledge in the social world, views, critical views about the social world that already exists, and self, as it were, self enforcing ideas which are being produced by others? So what impact can become is a very shallow reflection of what already exists. But that relationship has to be considered, it has to be thought out in terms of those terms of this relationship between those impacting and those seeking this information. The second thing I want to say here on this point as well is the notion that lies behind impact, which is, I think, a complicated idea that the social world always has the same stable appetite for certain kinds of knowledge and information. Now, it's certainly true that in the last 2 years, we might argue that there has been an increased government appetite for extending across the political climate, etc. There's another way I would suggest that what we want to impact
obviously, how there are various issues there. Certainly, the late very conditions are the we do get very important ideas which are very important. Over now, since I became interested in this, it occurred to me, I mean, at first of all, problems why you get to the level of ideas that you now think of it, but why are you designing to get more layers? But now I think it's a problem the other way around. Why did some people with ideas get recognized as people? Today, in my book, I discuss Einstein, for example. He published his book on special relativity, and he wants to recognize it for years. Now, how did he get so far? When I told him about this, it seemed unnatural. I mean, something kind of here. He went to this mistake about how I earned. And it's quite interesting to look at the case, how he was discovered what was recognized as a thing. One of the points I made in the book is that the leading journals didn't even say they were the Jews. Anyway, so you're right. I'm not saying this is a universal phenomenon, but it is very common in a sense. And the other point is that, you see, the people who do not recognize the people are not disappointed in this case, are not acting rationally. Not being stupid. Because there are a lot of cranks out there who get up at conferences that everybody agrees that something is a and they make wrong speech about how it's been wrong. And everybody says, oh, God, I'm a crank. They don't notice that they were a crank. So when someone asks about how they look for all wrong, one of the things matters. And in many cases, that would be correct for the reaction. Actually, in this case, it's wrong. So the point is, another way I'm saying is, let us follow it. It's fine, we'll be wrong. The problem we get to do with a few times is not the reasons to be but whether you're going to be happy,
in the spirit of curiosity and the imagination that I've brought to bear on this question. I want to think about the discourse of impact as part of the whole kind of architecture of audit. And I want to think about its affective dimensions, how it affects us at the level of bodies, emotions and feelings, because I think that's been somewhat significantly under-theorised. So it's a tad introspective, but I hope for a good purpose. And I really want to start and contribute to the way that the Academy itself, its key workers, its key stakeholders, in some extent ourselves, can generate our own discourse about what on earth is going on. Many people have intentions for us. I think it's about time that we started to regenerate intentions for ourselves. I don't mean that in an individualistic, detached mode, but I do think it's in the spirit of using our own resources to understand our own conditions of production, that's what I mean. There's lots of narratives of the Academy in the emergent sociology of higher education. It's about ruins, it's about the good old days. I'm not actually interested in contributing to that. I don't think the good old days were all that good for certain categories of persons in the Academy. So I think there's been some gains, but I would like to see more, and it's that kind of discourse I want to contribute to. Part of the inspiration for this comes from, a seminar series that I, with Louise Morley and colleagues at the Centre for Higher Education and Equity Research, started, which is about constructing some narratives and grammar about the university today. I just want to flag some of the vocabulary which has the disheartening, disaffecting effect on me of wanting me to walk out of the door. Now, I don't speak as a scientist, I speak as a social scientist. I bring to this discourse cultural studies, and which feminism, which critical theory, and which a whole lot of other things around the psychosocial. But I cannot understand the third definition. Perhaps someone can explain it to me later. It's accompanied by a lovely grid and a scattergram. But my point here is about the kind of further imposition of this kind of language. It's all about it seems to me, delegitimating in other words, our own commitments, our own passions, our own moral universes. It's like we're guilty until proven innocent, and we have to prove our innocence through our utility. So I'm quite mindful of what Mary said. And certainly in terms of other concerns I have, I think part of the discourse of impact, part of the relocation of higher education into the clutches of the Department of Business and Innovation is a kind of industrialisation of research. I'm thinking less about its scale than about its key vocabularies and the kind of thing that nourishes the discourse of impact. And I think one of the likely effects of having to account for ourselves through impact is apart from the teleology of it, in which we are now in our research grants have to anticipate what our impacts might be before we've done the research, and then spend several years after recovering and harvesting the impact from all sorts of places. I have an email box which says impact. So anybody sends me a little fan letter, not that I get many, I usually get other implications, I log it under impact. Yes, it's an ambiguous tip, I feel. And I certainly have seen a shift in education research, that's my community, one of my communities, to produce work of immense utility, which derives and thrives on the kind of discourse of behaviourism. in terms of what can we do about the moral panic about the working class. We've suddenly now got a certain re-legitimation in terms of policy gaze of the government. And there's lots of discourse about why aren't they aspiring. And there's a whole kind of thinning out, a depletion of resources to think about education inequity. Let's reduce to intervention studies. So it's like researchers' inoculation. So people rush along, do interventions. I don't know if anyone's read the brochure called Going the Extra Mile. Read it. My heart stopped. But it really is the reduction of poverty to culture. And from there, a whole set of other things follow about what we should do about recalcitrant subjects who refuse to convert themselves into nice middle-class subjects. Okay, so I'm interested, and I've been developing work with colleagues about impacts and audit effects on ourselves as the workers who are producing the knowledge, some of which ends we can't always control. Increasingly, we know we're being invited to kind of, there's an excitement to performativity, which I think is thinning out at notions of authenticity. Now, I use the word authenticity with some discomfort because I am from a post-structuralist social constructionist position, but there's something going on about when we have to align our subjectivity as performing to all these indicators. How much impact we've had, how many times our stuff's been cited, etc., etc. There's a thinning out of those commitments, certainly for me, brought me into the academy. And there's also a wooing of our already over-exercised passion for our work into other people's ends for us. And my thinking here is inspired by Sara Ahmed's work. And I'm thinking about the living of this new space of intensification of audit and having to line up with the dominant discourses, which are very, very policy driven. I'll just leave that there. I mean, I'm interested in emotions as they are felt on the pulse in the body of the skin, but I'm also interested in the kind of moral and affective economy of the academy in these conditions of intense competition. And for me, and it's hardly news, the evaluative is the register that seems to be endemic in the English, certainly the English education system. It's the main provoker, it seems to me, of all sorts of affects. And the failure to meet the criteria for progress, for success, for doing this, for doing that, is massively felt, I think. At the same time that it's massively felt, it's almost universally not spoken. I'm just going to skip. So I see the implication to evidence our impact as audit plus. I'm sure there'll be audit plus plus and super plus, just like, you know, there's a complete mania for the discourse of gradation, whether it's gold star, pink, things are gold star, silver star, sets, orders. I don't know if you heard the Tories yesterday, they were talking about the common sense of setting yet again. I mean, this obsession about grading, hierarchies, places, positioning, and so on and so forth. And I'm also interested in the kind of ironic confluence that's gone on. Just at the same time that capitalism's deconstructed, it has, of course, been rescued and been taken into public ownership. At the same time that this model, which apparently is so wonderful, is laid on us about the very aspirational space we should meet. And I can't believe that there is a kind of seamlessness about that that is open to challenge. But in this conversation today, it clearly is. And, you know, it's almost beyond irony, it's certainly beyond parody. that we've been asked to produce and produce and produce paper mountains, you know, that we never have time to actually read. I mean, this is not an original point, but I do see impact as yet another mode of our attempt to delegitimize our existence as those workers who have been privileged enough, and I know it's a privilege, it's a difficult privilege, but we have at one historic point in time been distanced from necessity to play with ideas, to think the unthinkable. I sound like a contestant on the X Factor, you know, to live the dream. But actually, it's the dream of the imagination I want to resuscitate. Because I think there's a massive fantasy invested in the discourse of impact, just like there's massive fantasies in the discourse of evidence-based policy-making, etc., etc. So I really would like to kind of interrupt the kind of gleeful austerity that seems to be around, in which impact is yet another stick to beat us with. So I think we really need to turn to our, what I traditionally call, and speculative call, the feminist lexicon. And I'm trying to think of what was it that got me into the academy first of all. And believe it or not, it was those seditious things called ideas. It was the gap between my experience and its representation and feminist knowledge, which spoke to me, which resonated with me, which ironically, of course, started outside the academy and then travelled in. And I travelled in with it on that wave of excitement and passion. And what was so fabulous about that knowledge, it reorganised my world for me. It produced new realities. It legitimated the realities I was living. And it allowed me to see things differently. And it's very easy for us to forget how housework was just housework until it got rebranded as the sexual division of labour. And that had impact on me and continues to do so. This is a particular text that captures for me a whole set of preoccupations I have with, I think, what is generative for me about knowledge, ideas, language and discourse. This is something from Barry Walkerdine, who is inspirational for me, and inspirational for many other women who come from particular sorts of spaces in the social, and who have had to think about their inheritance and their presence and their future. I like it because it's kind of angry, so it has lots of those illegitimate things in it called feelings and emotions, but it's intellectually robust because what her vocabulary went on to delineate was precisely about the complexities of social reproduction. Why is it, given we know what an unjust society we live in, why does it reproduce itself? And it's partly through her exploration of the psychosocial that allows us to explain our investment in those things that oppress us. And that has had massive impacts for me. And I think also it's about time we started generating and acknowledging our own desires in our work. Plenty of people, as I indicated, have desires on us and project desires onto us, some of which are highly problematic. I'm also interested in academic writing that is actually pleasurable, that is aesthetically crafted, that is nourishing. I'm interested in discourses about, you know, that's non-formulaic sociology. I speak as someone who's interested in Bourdieu, but I promise you, if I read another paper that invokes him, I should probably have it deconstruct, because, you know, there is sociology beyond Bourdieu, and there was before, and there will be after, and there is. However, I mean, his work's really important, of course. But I'm interested in work that engages the heart and the brain, and I'm interested in writing that is sparkly, connected, and resonant. And I think that, you know, it ought to be possible for us to start generating prose against the cadaverous prose we are forced to listen to in endless meetings about targets and this, that, and the other. It really does sap your spirit, you know? and I want our spirit to be nourished, at least my spirit to be nourished. It's presumptive of me to assume that you might share my imaginary or want to walk with me into some of this. And, of course, part of my feminist imaginary is texts that tell you something you have not thought, precisely working against the logic Mary characterised as the way this kind of teleology of impact is inviting us to sign up to things we already know in a common sense way about the world. This is a view of knowledge, this is a view of text, of discourse, of the distribution of some intellectual resources that allow us to think otherwise, that allow us to kind of step outside or think again about the norms through which we are constructed. It's an invitation to rumination, as Judith Butler says. It's an invitation not to collude in the discursive terms of our own production, which can so easily segue over into some of the narrative that is of such use value to our current economic and social dispositions. So it's an argument, finally, for the imagination. And thankfully, it's inspired by Apadurai, who and also, I think it's John Elliott, who used to be at Penn, and he was arguing that there's something about the imagination. No matter how many times people come for you and call you to account, call you to render yourself in a particular way so you can get recognition, the imagination always escapes the conditions of that kind of capture. And I think the university ought to be a space in which we nourish and cherish multiple forms of imagination, within and without. So.
Thank you very much, Mal, for that presentation. I do appreciate your raising the language of impact. One of the things that academia, of course, is excellent at is the killing of language and the proliferation of jargon. And I think impact is not in itself such an attractive word anyway. And it's sort of becoming uglier by the day as it is operationalized to have recourse to some sociological jargon in the form of the various measures that you indicated. Or otherwise is reduced into a very simple formula under which the natural sciences become industry, the social sciences become policy, and humanities become at best television, and at worst irrelevant. I want to pick up 4 points and to play with them and possibly in a contrary way that Val has raised. The first of these is about the policy fantasy. Fantasies around policy and the fantasies that politicians perhaps have about academic research. The second relates to Val's particular position in the higher education field and her comments on inspiration, ideas and imagination. The third is paper mounds and political writing. And then finally something about that competition, the intense competition that you referred to. And they're very short points. Val mentioned at the outset the formative nature of impact and audit, but also the performances in a simpler, more conventional sense around this. We have certain fantasies, many of them baleful, about the relationship of our research to policy, but equally I think there is a relationship on the other side. And I read recently a very nice piece by Margaret Weatherall from the Open University, in a recent number of Critical Social Policy, where she gives a very nice account of one engagement with the world of policy. And it doesn't get much better than this for a UK academic, when she goes to 10 Downing Street as part of this phalanx of academics and think tankers and experts and so on, to consult with Tony Blair, then Prime Minister, and his aides on a very important speech that he gave in December 2006 on multiculturalism. and on the need to integrate. I looked up the speech, I remember the speech quite well, and I looked it up having read Margaret Webber's book, and I couldn't find it. It seems to have been disappeared from the 10 Downing Street archives, but you can still find and the National Archives, indeed. But the burden of Webber's paper is this amazing build-up. You know, she gets the call to 10 Downing Street. Who else is going? There's an august guest list. She has to bring in all her network of researchers and engage with this large-scale research program with her. And the emails fly and the telephone conversations and the late-night meeting working. And so when they get to Downing Street, and, you know, they sit and they discuss it with Blair and his company. And he gives the speech, and she finds not the spirit of any of the discussion in that speech. And it's a completely sort of formulaic piece of rhetoric on Blair's part. So after this great build-up, you're left with this sense of anticlimax at the end. But of course, number 10, in a way, needs to be seen to be doing that on the other side also. The result, she says, well, probably nothing. But I need you to read the article, and I do recommend it. The second point I wanted to raise, coming out of Val's position on higher education and her comments on inspirational ideas, Val and I had an exchange prior to this afternoon, and one of her really good lines is one that she left out, that this perhaps was an exception you skipped, but Val referred to the corralling of the imagination in the service of the mundane and the ages of impact. And I was struck by this idea, and I thought, well, I'd quite like to make an argument for the value of the mundane. The mundane ways in which people in higher education, not just as researchers, but as educators, actually have an impact. And many of these mundane forms of impact are not auditable. Although, with credit to our next speaker, of course, everything being auditable these days, are not easily auditable. It's all of those conversations that you have with distant people that maybe you can put in your impact box now, the things you send on, but sort of the rotating credit that happens in academic life that is difficult and just stupid to quantify because it would be more time-consuming than even, I think, the Department of Business and Innovation would consider worthwhile. But other of the mundane ways in which people working in higher education have impact are quite readily auditable but are not subject to dispersion of impact and its assessment. Teaching is the most obvious case in point here, and I'm not making an argument for enhanced audit of teaching, but if we think in terms of our own biographies, as you were, the individuals who have the most impact on me and have been most inspiring, apart from Karl Marx, are the people who have taught me, including probably especially the people who taught me Karl Marx. This for me is a reality of impact, and it's one that is quite divorced in spite of the lip service that's given to research-led teaching and the various kinds of audits around teaching. It's still seen as quite separate. The role of higher education in education, the role of higher education in research seems to be becoming more and more separated. The other aspect of the mundane, which I'd like to say a word for here, bears on Val's point about citation and the importance of citation. I recently saw a list of the most cited sociologists in the world, and it was full of the usual suspects, mainly North American. But of course, sitting at the top of the list of citations is Anthony Giddens. And clearly he has had a great deal of impact, for good or ill, in the world of sociology and beyond, in the world of policy for a while. But I would put it to you that one of the major impacts that Giddens' career has had, that is in the sixth edition of his textbook, now in publication, and surely the seventh is in preparation. He's probably reached more readers through this means than he has through some of his more reputable writing. And of course, writing for students, though he do reach a large audience, is not something which is taken seriously at all. I mean, it's just completely reputable now. Of the audit and impact culture. And if we would like to be read, then writing for student audiences is certainly one way to do that. Thirdly, it brings me very briefly to this concept of paper mounds and paper writing. I hadn't thought I was going to say anything about this, but it resonated so much. As someone involved in the editorial about academic journals, I think one of the outcomes of the impact culture is the overproduction of academic work, which I hesitate. I mean, we dignify it by calling it research, but some of it is just writing for writing's sake, it seems to me. So while I think there may be benefits of the current research audit culture for promoting research writing and even promoting quality, I think there is certainly a case that it is productive of a greater irrelevance, writing precisely to the target and the tick boxes. And my final point concerns the intense competition, as Val notes, that academics are increasingly subject to. Another thing I've read recently is a piece by Catherine Smith in the current number of the British Journal of Sociology, which is the March issue, on research policy and funding. She's done a sociology of sociologists, a sociology of researchers in the field of health inequalities, and they speak about precisely the kinds of concerns that we are talking about today. And one of the points that her interviewees make, and that she discusses at a certain degree of length, is the problem of credibility within this field of competition. And in fact, many researchers, many of our colleagues, who are producing policy-relevant work, who are being heard in various corridors of power, or who are ticking the boxes on impact, are held in a degree of contempt by their colleagues who see themselves as being dedicated more to the free-thinking intellectual life to which they were referred us. And I think this is a reality that's one that I certainly see in my own academic context, that part of the competition is not just around who is most auditable, but the fact that many of those colleagues who are not seen as having credibility by other academic colleagues. And this seems to be a very divisive trend within academia, and perhaps a rather depressing thought on which to write.
Thank you.
its consequences. I think when you're suddenly lining up with it and positioning it and positioning others with it, and it feels positioning it. Well, I've got to perform in this kind of way to dispose of your guilt. Well, yeah, I do think there is something that kind of deeply puritanical, but certainly in the English side, that makes any claim to be an intellectual or highly problematic in a way that I don't think travels in continental Europe. So I think that's part of it. But I think you're right, and I would welcome and thrive and engage with this kind of discourse generally. And I would hope for conversations and exchange and generalisation of this. I think we do need some kind of mass kind of thinking about this, in our own terms, but not as lecturers to others, but as listeners with others as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. I absolutely need some not to be but to keep to time,
I've got a PowerPoint slide, but I'm not going to put it up. If any of you want it, you can get it from me afterwards. But I thought it might be better to do without it. I'm very much talking in a very complimentary way to the previous presentations. It indeed occurs to me that I'm really only just got footnotes to some of the things that have been said already. But I wanted to start with two sort of stories. One is, I'm a non-executive director of a very large financial services organisation, so it's been a very interesting couple of years. And one of the things that the financial regulator wants to do is for people like me to be more challenging in the boardroom. And the evidence that they want to see that we're being more challenging is in the minutes. So my colleagues and I are very concerned that the minutes are written in such a way that they reflect our questions and challenges. Now, that didn't used to happen, but now we're very concerned with appropriate traces of our challenging in the minutes. So it's not just academics. That's the point of that story. The second one is that, like Val, I also have an impact file, which I keep, and it's got lots of great stuff in it, actually. But it is a vulgar and sort of narcissistic activity. But I don't think I'm alone in this. I think CVs are getting longer. Almost nothing is left out. And there seems to be a tremendous opportunity to provide a sort of psychoanalytic explanation for some of these traces that we seem determined to leave behind in our records of what we do. Esplin and Sadler, in a marvellous article in the American Journal of Sociology about rankings in 2007, talk of this kind of pre-audit activity of individual agents in terms of reactivity. And that reactivity is both cognitive and administrative. But it starts rather, as Foucault reminds us, in sort of very mundane registers of activity, the impact files. Even before we know what the final winners are going to be look like, we are anticipating and creating registers and traces, which will come to have an effect on us in the way that Bauer was intimating. And I think all of this, I think, forces us really to touch on the very last question that just before I came on, forces us to think more of, before we get too normative in this space, more about the sort of sociology of knowledge and the sociology of our own disciplines as a way of stepping back from the impact discussion. I think we need to ask how academic disciplines and our own fields and subfields and peculiarities, how they are connected in some way, both to each other and to wider domains of practice, for want of a better term. And I think when we reflect in that way, we see that these connections are very complex and varied across space and time. we can tell kind of broad brush genealogies of disciplines and say that anthropology originated in imperial projects of control, which may not be true, it sounds great. But although we have those origins, many fields and disciplines have acquired a kind of relative autonomy, which I don't think is very well understood by the academic practitioners within it. And I think part of what is happening to us, and this is exactly your point that we made earlier, part of what's happening to us is actually we've forgotten about those relations of connections to worlds of practice. And we've forgotten how to develop interesting counter-narratives about our own role in the world, not just through teaching, but through other ways as well. So we should definitely be sceptical about myths of academic autonomy, but I think there is a sort of paucity of knowledge, certainly in the area I'm involved in, reflexive knowledge about the sort of connection, the complex connections of practice, which are not just people applying stuff out there in the world. And there's a lot of very sort of field-specific variety across social work, law. I was always very shocked that people teaching law in this place would actually go and also be judges, or barristers, sorry, in the Inns of Court. And there's a model of impact, if ever there was one. Of course, ironically, it doesn't count in this current setting. So there are lots of different kinds of impacts that were implicated previously. And of course, the one story of impact that I think Danmar needs telling is the role of financial economics in the mess that we're currently in, which touches on the point about positive and negative impacts that was made earlier. Of course, none of this is new. I mean, policymakers have been fretting about the competitiveness of economies for a long time, and our R&D spend relative to other countries and so on. And I think the point was made that ESRC, if you apply for an ESRC grant, then you've been engaged in this sort of stuff before, in trying to demonstrate engagement and the impacts before you ever have them. It's quite right. But I think there's a very distinctive and novel ambition, something that's sort of a step change, if you like, in the current proposals around the REF, to actually have demonstrable benefits, I think is the phrase, demonstrable benefits on the economy and society. It's quite a new thing. And I think we do probably need to do a little bit of conceptual clearing up work around the impact space. Impact is a kind of relational concept, it's a collision concept, if you take it like that. And we have to really be clear about what we, impact of what, on whom, and when. I mean, your presentation spoke to sort of the issue of time very, very ably. But I think there's this issue of the kind of ontology of impact. What particular units are we talking about which are kind of having the impact, which I think there is a great deal of unclarity about. Of course, the most extreme ontology is of the individual research paper, an identifiable unit whose causal impact can be traced to these people called users who then change their behaviour for the benefits of society. But I think that mythical model is just lurking in the background as a kind of invisible benchmark, more or less an invisible benchmark for a lot of this discussion. And of course, my experience with users, or maybe we call them impactees, my experience is that they don't cite you, they steal your ideas, they're nicking stuff all the time and plagiarising. I mean, they may not mention you, as you said, I think it's a your lovely vignette that you just get ignored. But actually, I think they steal and reconstruct a lot. So there's a real kind of issue of the impactee, how that group of persons, whatever they are, need to be themselves really constructed, not just socially constructed, but really well managed and educated in some sense. And that's the real issue there, because they can't be controlled. I mean, I think we can control engagement, which is some softer edge of this stuff, but there's a very uncontrollable element of impact. Makes it so bizarre. Of course, researchers themselves, me and my colleagues in the LSE, have a huge amount of symbolic capital and are drawn into these 10 downstream meetings and so on. where they almost become hybrid policymakers. And of course, that's not impact either. And that's because you've lost that distance that allows your research to have the impact at a distance. So actually, the irony here is the closer you get to practice and policy making, you don't tick the boxes either. So there's a very sort of strange effects that might result from people withdrawing from a really direct engagement, where they might actually be rather good translators and mediators in what they do into the policy domain, and just trying to market research papers. And then, of course, there's the other entity, is the institution itself, which we can think of, basically, LSE, as a very complex portfolio of activities. And I think thinking of impact at that level would, I think, in quite an interesting way, force the sort of governors, whoever they are, of this organisation, to actually define the intellectual topography in a way that hasn't been done before. So I'm sort of, as the units get larger, I'm sort of a bit more in favour of them, because they provide rather challenging opportunities for sort of whole of organisation narratives. I'm rather reminded of the kind of business review that private organisations now put at the front of the annual report. You probably don't know about this, but they have accounts and then they have this business review at the front. And actually, they're rather interesting documents, narratives with metrics in them, but not unintelligent. And it seems to me if one could get into that a little bit more, that genre of writing around these issues, that would be really quite interesting. I'm running short of time, I know, but on whom, we've already talked about impact on other academics and teachers and through teaching. But I think it's quite interesting that the kind of standardised model of impact which is coming through the proposals is very much a problem-solving notion of impact, as opposed to, as already been said, kind of problematising impact. I think this sort of asymmetry of, the only impact you can have is sort of positive discovery-type impact is really something that we ought to challenge. But of course, all this is a product really of the enfranchisement of the increased authority of groups, non-academic groups, around academics, the stakeholder world that we now live in, who project their aspirations onto what we do. And I think we kind of need to have a better understanding of that world, rather than simply thinking of them as stakeholders, but thinking of the more complex sets of engagements and relationships that might exist almost on a field-specific basis. Part of me thinks we're kind of getting what we deserve, and I think this is your point again, that we vacated a space, an audit space, that got occupied for us, and there's a lot of catching up to do, more complex narratives of accountability, because I think there's no getting away from that. Beneath the moaning and groaning, I think there's a real responsibility not just to challenge impact, but to offer these alternatives. I won't deal with the time horizon issue, because that's been dealt with, but there's a kind of auditability issue naturally, a kind of epistemological issue, is when can we know that impacts have happened? And of course, the logic of auditability, which in my own work I sort of see as rather ubiquitous, provides a real constraint on any more, what you might call, more intelligent narrative of impact, which would speak more to the kind of differential, complex relationships that fields have with domains of practices. Research is often like a pebble thrown into a pond with very contingent ripples that may have many diverse and uncertain effects. And you sort of see it as a bet, and I think that's what Donald was really talking about. We have to protect the portfolio of bets that is research, even in the social sciences. So I feel there are prospects for a kind of what I would call the acceptable face of narrative, of impact narratives. We're a long way from that, and my fears are that the kind of the logic of demonstrable effects, the logic of auditability, is pushing us in these other directions which which have already been mentioned. There's some very strange paradoxes, which Donald has touched on as well, of hardwiring impacts into individual behaviours, not just the paradox of my strange narcissistic file of all the kind of impacts I think I've had on journalists and so forth, but actually that when something which you want as an outcome, when you design that thing as a target, you can actually have a worse outcome. And there's lots and lots of research examples where that is the case. The case I read of a research laboratory where they wanted to improve the production of patents, patentable products from the scientists. So they made the patents a target for each scientist. Lo and behold, the number of patents went down. And it's just a kind of classic example. We can expect lots of gaming, lots of strange behaviours where when a journalist talks to me, I say to them things, strange things like, would you mind dropping me an email and telling me how much you enjoy talking to me? strange but true. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of gaming and sort of managed impact because we all have to survive, don't we? Feelings run very, very high around this subject, as we've already seen. I don't think it's possible to sort of defend knowledge for its own sake, although, and even in the humanities, there must be some notion of sort of cultural benefit which needs to be sort of articulated. The problem with this impact requirement is it's very hard to be against it in the abstract, and I think that's the real challenge, is to get a better understanding for us as academics, to get a better understanding of connectedness. And to, before we come too upset, and then to develop more sort of complex but also digestible narratives of performance around that. I think I'll leave it there.
Thanks very much. And I think my response is basically drawing on a theme that's been emerging over a little while now, particularly in some of the questions. And that's this issue of whether we are kind of victims of our own failure, the extent to which, I think, as Mike put it, we fail to inhabit this very important terrain of relevance. Or even the word impact, of how we kind of imagine, model, and manage our relationship as academics to other domains of practice in the world. Is it the fact that we've not offered other kinds of models for how to manage these relationships? Is that the reason why we end up with these kinds of extremely impoverished order? And are there possibilities of, you know, other ways of imagining how we engage with the world? Again, I think, you know, Mike said it very clearly. I mean, you know, and I think it's, I don't think any of us had a great desire to, my colleagues have mentioned this, but, you know, terms like academic freedom as an absolute was a license to be irrelevant. I mean, it's not something that anyone's actually trying to advocate. Or endorsing myths of a kind of autonomous, pure knowledge. I don't think this is the issue for most people. Again, the issue is, or again, it's, you know, offering some version of absolute non-accountability. You know, I'm off in an ivory tower of my own. I mean, this is not the kind of language that anyone's, I think, particularly interested in. The question is, how do we develop more productive relationships with a whole range of constituencies? Such that our knowledge enters into the world in more and more complex, again, productive, unpredictable, adventurous, etc. ways. And I just want to offer, I mean, from my own experience, one of the reasons I've been thinking a lot about this over the last 10 years or so, I've been working on issues of new media and development, where I'm dealing with an incredible range of users, from UNESCO bureaucrats through to villagers in various far-flung places, and everyone in between. And obviously this involves an enormous range of relationships, each one of which has to be thought through in different ways, and each one of which matures over time. And my sense of how I'm relating to people, how I'm managing these relationships, has changed enormously, and even a term like impact, which is very, actually, I value that, means different things in different contexts here. I want mature and responsible connections to various beneficiaries, that people use the kinds of projects I've been studying. I want combative and openly conflictual relations with policymakers. I want everyone always to get angry and argue. I want to engage with project workers or agency bureaucrats in very different terms, because there are very different kinds of relationships that have to manage in different kinds of impacts that I want to have, and so on and so forth. I would add here that if I'm trying to think of alternative models, I'll be absolutely unashamed. To me, the ultimate model, the kind of gold standard for managing these evolving relationships and the complexities in relationships, is what I've learned from ethnography. That's to say that these are highly complex human relationships that the researcher I enter into, that they are all in ways sui generis, you have to make up from scratch. And this is an alternative, this is the way that I think through issues like impact. What's the incredible web of evolving, of relationships evolving over time, through which my ideas, my thoughts, my articles, whatever, my speech might enter into different kinds of social worlds. So, complex, mediated in highly diverse ways, evolving over time, as reflexive as I am, the people I talk to can make it, and hopefully inventive, creative, unpredictable, and a whole range of other things. Okay. I'm saying this, and probably also very difficult to rationalize, as anyone knows if you try to write a project proposal for an ethnography. How do I predict or give clear indicators of what the hell is going to happen? I don't know, and that's really why I work that way, and most people who work that way do. So I basically, the problem I think that Mike makes very clear here, because he's talking about audit, much as about impact, is the problem here is the way in which these models of impact are based on horribly impoverished, reductive, and unconvincing ways of modeling relationships between researchers and the various people and social worlds that they deal with. Okay? The problem is the model that results from. And again, I think we've got a certain responsibility to come up with other ways of modeling, or at least having the courage of our convictions, let's say, for example, my invocation ethnography, to have the courage of the conviction of my own relationship to the world and say that I should be judged on that basis. And are there ways in which that could be done? I've always loved the subtitle of my book, Audit Society, which is Rituals of Verification. That's to say, it captures the kind of emptiness and formalism of a lot of these kinds of methodologies which inhabit the space that we inhabit it properly. They're rituals. They're formal or they're virtual ways of garnering trust from the wider society who actually doesn't know what the hell we're doing. And these methods are not going to help. I can give examples from development work as well. I mean, it's not just institutions like PEC, but UNESCO and all kinds of other agencies follow exactly the same kind of line of trying to formalize impact in ways which there are almost no relationship to what's happening. I think the other point I'd like to make in response is that Mike's presentation, I have the benefit of the PowerPoint, so I'm going to do the quotes there. One of the things, I think it makes clear, one of the reasons that audit of impact is so reductive and impoverished is because it's based on the idea of treating research as an independent variable with a causal impact, as you said, the research. The whole point of audit here is to be able to trace unproblematically some event in the world to a piece of paper that someone has talked to. Okay? It brings me back to, I mean, I spent a long time in media studies, and my first research was on advertising, where this kind of issue is endemic. The whole point in these fields is, and the whole idea of impact, media impact, is to say, this representation caused this in the world. And we all know this to be an absolute, it's crap. Okay? This is not the way in which representations, let alone our reports or our articles, circulate in the world and the way they enter into this world. It's not, called life, you should want of an effect out there to, our research, like media, like advertising, inhabit, again, complex and highly mediated social worlds. If we were actually in the game of trying to understand, again, the linkages and managing in productive ways the linkages between our research and the worlds that we're engaging with, then we wouldn't be concerned about the impact of this one article on, you know, the world, this kind of global attribution. However you measure it, and however, whatever technical means we use to try to measure that impact, we'd again be concerned with the ways in which our ideas and are part of highly complex relationships that are built up over time. And there must be other ways in which we can imagine an alternative imaginary of how we actually impact on the world. I suppose the final point is, which I quite like from my peers, the problem is actually not impact. It's audit. It's the way in which we actually try to model, again, the ways in